G'day. Thanks for joining us in this Broadway Spotlight edition of The Stages podcast, a Spotlight replay brought to you by Academy Travel, a leading specialist in small group cultural tours. And we've got exciting news for you. Join me in January 2024 as Academy Travel takes us to the city that never sleeps on an immersive and jam-packed adventure into theatre, opera, jazz and cabaret. A 10-day tour in which we will sample the best of Broadway, the Metropolitan Opera and jazz in Brooklyn, alongside a host of cultural experiences at museums and galleries populating the Big Apple. As your stage's host, I'll be leading the tour, accompanying participants in an exciting array of activities that are bound to delight, thrill and engage the eager theatre fan. What can be better than diving into arts and culture in the greatest city in the world, the Big Apple, the city that never sleeps? Find further information at the Academy Travel website, academytravel.com.au, and search Theatre in New York Best of Broadway Tour. To whet the appetite, Stages will be visiting conversations with Australian artists who conquered the Great White Way in a series of Broadway Spotlight episodes, brought to you by Academy Travel. Known affectionately as Frosty the Showman, impresario John Frost has been at the pinnacle of musical theatre in Australia for several decades. The Gordon Frost Organisation has contributed much of the commercial product that has traversed stages around the country. His productions have garnered a swag of local awards, as well as two Tony Awards on the Broadway stage, for his celebrated production of The King and I. John joined Stages for a second time in an episode titled Back to Broadway, which considered the 2021 Tony Awards and John's own forays into the theatre of Broadway. John Frost was a guest on the Stages podcast in September 2021.
Thanks, Peter. Thank you for asking me.
Well, especially with the Tony Awards happening, well, depending on when the listeners are listening to this, within about 24 hours or maybe it's in the past. But I thought, who better to give us some insight than your good self, who's been to a number of Tony Awards and, of course, has two of them in your study. Where do you keep your Tony Awards?
They sit near the front door in a big glass cabinet with my other awards. So it's like an awards I've got, yeah.
Have you got a pool room?
Yes, that's yes. Yeah.
Now, before we do launch into discussing Broadway, can I ask you about the recent, because you started GFO, the Gordon Frost Organisation, it's about 40 years ago, I think now, founded that with Ashley Gordon.
Yeah.
But GFO is no longer now. You've become Crossroads Live. Can you fill us in on that?
Yeah. What happened was about a year before COVID hit, I was asked by this company in America called Crossroads Live, would I be interested in selling the Gordon Frost Organization because of its track record and its... I don't say this braggingly, but, you know, we had a very successful, financially successful last 10, 12 years or so. And at that stage, I was here or there about it, and I didn't know, and I didn't want to give up any of my sort of independence in that. But anyway, look, I said, let's go down the road and just see what happens. So they did all the, negotiations and they paid me what I wanted. And basically now the situation is that we've phased out the name Gordon Frost and adopted Crossroads Live Australia, which marries up to a company in England called Crossroads Live UK, which is run by a fellow that I've done a lot of shows with called David Ian. So we both sold our companies, and subsequently Crossroads Live has bought interests in companies in the Philippines, in Singapore. We've bought into or own 50% of Kudos Pantomimes, which is now Crossroads Live's Pantomimes in the UK, which do 30 to 40 pantos a year. And so we're building the company globally. And it gives me more access now because of finances, and certainly since COVID, to go out and raise money for a musical is difficult. It's really difficult. So what Crossroads do supply is the funding for shows. It gives me a leg up on if there is a show that's being developed in America that I have good feelings about, or in London for that matter, or even in Australia, they will stump up the advance monies to get the show on, and we'll have a major investment. And subsequently, what we've done is Crossroads Live Worldwide have invested in a lot on new things coming into New York, certainly a lot of things in the UK, and we'll try to do that with Australia too at the same time. So it gives me, it puts me in a strong position with my competition, I suppose, globally, to get the Australian rights for things, because I'm not running around now looking for and scraping money together. I just go, and if we all think it's a good idea, they write a check for me and I pay that across to get the rights.
Gee, that's a huge reach. So, did you ever anticipate that you would have that reach when you started at the Footbridge Theatre?
You always dream of those things. But in those days, the furthest thing from our mind was either selling. And in those days, in the early 80s, mid-80s, no one ever wanted to buy entertainment companies other than, you know, MGM or Paramount or whatever, certainly not live entertainment. And then it all came together, and of course COVID hit, and so it couldn't have been better timing for me, and I think for everybody at GFO or Crossroads Australia now. So it's good. It's a good position, and they're great guys to work with, and to have somebody like David Ian on side in the UK brings a lot of power to us here. So, you know, I think we're going to see over the next few years, certainly from my office, is maybe a lot more newer shows, and not necessarily, whilst we will continue to revive shows like Annie and Grease and Dirty Dancing
in Chicago,
we will see a lot more in Chicago, of course. we'll see a lot more new musicals too from those countries, and hopefully from Australia.
Brilliant. Now, in my research for other episodes I'm about to record, I've been looking through a lot of old GFO programs. And in those early programs, you were known as John E. Frost. What happened to the E? When did you drop that or decide to drop that?
I don't know. I think I was going through a stage where I thought I had to legitimize myself. And I thought E sounded good. And I think I went to a numerologist who said you should use the E. And then I went through, after I'd spoken to the numerologist, I think I had a string of flops. And so I dumped the E and just left it with John Frost. That's how that was many years ago when I was much, much younger and not as wise as I am now.
As we've touched on briefly in that conversation, COVID has really sort of given the industry a very tough time. It's a precarious road to navigate. Have you been doing it? Because you managed to get Pippin on, but I think 9 to 5 was about to go onto the stage or into rehearsal when it had to be shut down.
Yeah, we were all contracted. We'd signed the theatre agreement. We were a week away from commencing rehearsals with 9 to 5, and hence the dreaded, what was it, March 15 or 13 or something, happened, and we had to close 5 shows. We had that about to open. We had Charlie and the Chocolate Factory in just finishing its tech rehearsals in Brisbane and sitting on millions of dollars in advance bookings. We had Book of Mormon in Auckland, and on the Thursday night we opened it, and on the Sunday night we closed it. And again, millions of dollars in advance bookings, and we had to hand that back. We had Shrek in Melbourne, which was halfway through a Melbourne season. There must have been another show on somewhere. What's that about?
Magic Mike?
Of course, Magic Mike was happening at the same time. So, you know, it was just closing shows and putting a lot of people out of work. And in those, you know, in that period, we all thought this is only going to be for 3-4 months or whatever, and we'll be fine. Well, it's been a nightmare ever since for everybody. And it's the indecision, I think, that none of us, you know, we don't know what's around the corner. I'd like to think now that everybody's getting double vaxxed and it'll be, you know, life will come back into the industry come the end of this year.
Well, the industry in the States, the great Broadway, the Great White Way, they've been doing it hard for a long time, but are slowly creeping back. Springsteen has been performing since June. And then in recent weeks, a whole lot of shows have returned to the stage. It's be interesting to see how that goes, won't it? Because they're so dependent on the tourist trade, whether that can continue, maintain a continuity.
I think the problem is going to be over there is that I think the established hits that have been running for 10, 20 years are going to have a tougher time than the newer shows because, you know, a lot of your listeners have been to New York and they've done the tourist thing and they go every 18 months or whenever, 2 years. But, you know, people are still going to see those shows that have been sitting there forever. And I think without that and what they'll have to live on are the locals, basically. The locals and people within America and probably a few British tourists that are coming in now. So I think, you know, the newer musicals will probably get a chance to get a leg up as such, where the older ones will have a much more difficult time in regaining their momentum that they had. Not that I want to see any shows close, but it will be harder. And it was very refreshing to see the other night, you know, the reopening of Wicked, which I produced here in Australia, reopened back on Broadway. And again, in the touring company reopened, I think, somewhere down in Texas, to great acclaim and to a lot of hysteria, which was great. So I think things like Wicked will be all right, but I don't know about the other ones.
Streaming platforms.
The time will tell.
That will indeed. Streaming platforms have given us an opportunity to access live performance with shows like Hamilton, Come From Away has just been released on one of the streaming services. Diana was filmed professionally. Do you think that's going to be the way of the future, that more and more stage plays will be filmed to be streamed to a worldwide audience? Because it's certainly been a great thing to have access to those Broadway productions.
Well, it is a great thing for people like you and I, people in the business. But you know, because we think, oh, good, we'll have that, we'll keep that, we'll collect that. But really, I think the Mr. and Mrs. Average don't really care about it. And for instance, you know, you look at Hamilton, that the one that Disney did. It was beautifully filmed and it was fantastic and it was great to have to keep that original cast to see them perform the show. But I think at the end of the day, there's nothing like sitting in a theatre and experiencing it live. I don't think that will ever go, and I don't think any of these things that they do show, I don't think it's going to damage the industry at all. I think if anything, it could, you know, could enhance in a way. You know, we'll all watch Diana and we'll all sit there and go, God, next trip to New York, I want to see that live. You know, we will do that. I don't know if Mr. and Mrs. Punter would want to do it, will be sitting down looking desperately for Diana to appear, let alone Come From Away or anything else. And it's never the same anyway. You know, they're high class archivals, really. That's all I think they are. I can never sit through them. I can't watch them, really. I watched a bit of Hamilton. I got bored with them because I'd rather sit and see it live.
In the moment.
In the moment, yeah.
Yeah. Well, with the return to Broadway, we're also seeing the return of the Tony Awards after a 12-month hiatus. 79th annual Tony Awards. We didn't see them last year because of COVID's interruption. This year it's taking place at the Winter Garden Theatre, which of course was the home for Funny Girl for many years, and Cats, and I think most recently Mamma Mia.
And Maine with Angela Lansbury.
Yeah.
Opened there. I think, did West Side Story open there? I don't know. Can't remember. Maybe not. No, it didn't. So I think it's great that the Tonys are going to be back in a theatre and out of Radio City Music Hall. I was lucky enough when I won my first Tony. It was done on the set of Phantom of the Opera, the Majestic. And I think that was either the last year or second to last year it played in a legit house, and then it went to Radio City. So it'll be interesting to see as we move on over the years if it will go back to Radio City or stay where it is.
It's only the second time that the awards have been held at the Winter Garden. The first time was in 1975 for the 29th Tony Awards. Our hosts this year are Audra McDonald and Leslie Odom Jr. Audra's won 5 Tony Awards and she's nominated again this year. She could be a 6-time winner.
What is she nominated for this year? I can't, because I missed, because of COVID, we're sort of a bit threw us out of whack.
She's nominated for Best Performance by an Actress in a Leading Role in a Play for Frankie and Johnny and the Claire de Lune.
Oh, yeah, Tom Curtehay. Yeah, he produced that. Yeah. Oh, I hope they win that. That's good. He's a friend of mine.
It's good to know Tony winners. At the end of the Tony Awards, they're going to have a big concert back to Broadway, which will be a lot of fun. Unfortunately, in Australia, I think the only way we can catch it is through Paramount Plus, the new streaming service this year.
Yeah, so we all got to pay money to watch. That's a bore.
How do you normally watch it?
Mind you, through Fox. But so I pay money too, don't I? But I used to love that thing, on a Monday morning, that public holiday Monday in June. We'd all sit and watch it, and it was terrific. Come through in the morning and then they'd cut it and edit and just put it out at night. But for some reason, they're not doing it this year. So I don't know if Foxtel have lost the contract or they don't want to do it anymore or whatever. It'll be a shame. But I suppose we'll all have to subscribe to Paramount.
Yeah, we'll catch it on YouTube that night.
We'll catch it on YouTube like we all do.
Yeah. So the Tony started in 1947 and the American Theatre Wing established it. Do you know how they got their name?
Yeah, from Antoinette Perry.
Perry, indeed. Who was an actress, director, producer.
She was an actress, director, and they named it after her. From then it used to be just a medal. They'd give you a medal in a nice little box. So it was never the award that it is now. And it used to be done as a dinner, I think.
Some of the big winners that night were Jose Ferrer, Arthur Miller, Helen Hayes, Ingrid Bergman, Patricia Neal, and Agnes DeMille. Great names of the past.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It was quite iconic watching every award ceremony and the token appearance by Isabel Stevenson. Did you ever meet her?
No, I never met her, but Ted Chapin, who is a friend of mine, who was the head of Rodgers and Hammerstein. He sat on that committee for a few years and he got to know her quite well. He said she was tough, you know what I mean? But she had, got it to where it was and all of that. And she was swell, she was great. She was a great mover and shaker as such. Yeah, she looked 110 when I first started watching the Tonys in the 80s and that, and she still looked it 20 years later. So, and she used to keep talking, if I remember rightly, and all that. You had to get a hook to get her off stage. And everybody seemed to be quite bored.
the orchestra would swell in and it'd be time for it to go.
That's right. Get rid of it.
So The King and I, you actually won Best Revival of a Musical, and Roger Kirk won Best Costume Design, Brian Thompson Best Set Design, and yourself, a production that originated in Australia. Tell me about that evening in the lead up to the Tony Awards. What were you doing? What did you wear? Who did you take?
Let me tell you, it started, The King and I was a passion of mine. I always wanted to do it. And I remember having Chris Renshaw, the director. I couldn't get a director to direct it. I offered it to Richard Werrett. I offered it to Gail Edwards. I offered it to another Australian to direct it. And they all turned it down. So Chris Renshaw was sort of the last on my list, and he was in town directing Mikado for Opera Australia, or the Australian Opera in those days. And I met him at a dinner party with the wonderful Diana Bliss, the late Diana Bliss, and she introduced me to him. And Brian Thompson and myself and Roger Kirk, I remember sitting around a barbecue table. I was living in Glebe in a terrace house at the time, and I had an outdoor area, and we sat there with a lot of wine and a barbecue going, and Brian came up with the wonderful idea of using all the elephants and the red and all of that. And my passion was, I didn't want to see a ship on stage, because the curtain goes up and they're on the bow of a ship, and I didn't want to see that. And it was my idea to bring that scene onto the shore of Siam or Bangkok. And it grew from that. And then Brian, of course, you know, we flew Brian to Thailand with Chris Renshaw, and they walked right through the Royal Palace, and or what they were allowed to do, and got a lot of ideas from that. And hence, you know, the design was, and it still is magnificent. And we got the Adelaide Festival Centre to co-produce it with us. And myself and Tim McFarlane, who was running Adelaide at the time, raised the money for the show. And a lot of the money came through the Queensland Performing Arts Centre, the Perth Theatre Trust, the Adelaide Festival Centre, the Victorian State Opera, which was Ken McKenzie Forbes at the time, and the Victorian Arts Centre, and independent money at the time. And that's another. Did I ever tell you that it's a great story, where I had to raise about $500,000 for it. And I had this one investor, somebody said, oh, you should go to this guy and meet him in King's Cross. He's got a lot of money. So I went and met with him, and he was a detective or a private. He was a private detective. I won't mention any names, but he leant over and he had this gun in his pocket. And he said, you've got a guarantee I'm going to get this $500,000 back. And I said, well, this is show business.
Yeah.
And you can't guarantee it. The show might be a flop. He said, I don't think so. It won't be a flop, and sort of flashed the revolver at me. So I left it at that. I never took his money, thank God, because I might have been at the bottom of the harbour by now. But that was just one of the wonderful stories that will go in a book one day. But anyway, I'm diverting from it. So we put The King and I went on in 6 months. We got it up in 6 months. It was designed. It was cast. And, of course, Hayley Mills came out to do it. And it was like a royal visit when we opened in Adelaide. She was mobbed, absolutely mobbed. And we toured around Australia with it. And we went to Perth, and Hayley couldn't do Perth. So an actress called Nari Dawn Porter, who was a New Zealand actress who lived in London, and she was in the original television series, The Forsyth Saga, who Noel Coward said she was, what did he say? Something like, who are the worst three actresses in the world? And the answer was Nari Dawn Porter. Anyway, Nari, he wasn't a terrible actor. He was quite good, actually. But someone, I was talking to an agent before she came out to Australia to do Perth, and this agent said to me, they said, oh, by the way, Nari never goes to an opening night. And I said, oh, the party. And he said, no, the show. I said, what do you mean? He said, she hasn't opened a show in the last 10, 15 years. I said, really? I said, oh, God, okay. So anyway, Nari Dawn Porter comes out and she has costume fittings and we rehearse her in Adelaide or wherever we were, in Sydney, I think, and we go to Perth. Tech Week happens in Perth. She gets a cold and she comes back. And then come opening night, I get a phone call saying, hello, darling, I can't go on. So I went and visited her in bed with the flu or a voice problem, and she never opened Perth. And an actress, Australian actress called Christine Marnie, was her understudy, and Christine went on for the opening or for the first four performances. So it was true. She never opened a show. So wow. Certainly didn't open my show. and sadly, she's passed away now, but she was a real character. So what was the original question we were talking about?
You know, that night going to the Tony Awards. How did you spend
it? Oh, the Tony Awards. Yeah.
Is it, so you walk the red carpet?
Yeah, it did all that. So anyway, Rodgers and Ted Chapin comes to Australia. No, a man called Tom Briggs, who worked for Rodgers and Hammerstein, I've got to do all this, who licensed me the show, comes to Australia because part of the deal was three or four first-class tickets to Australia, hotels, you know, the whole kit and caboodle for the Rodgers and Hammerstein people. So they send over this man called Tom Briggs. Tom comes over, falls in love with the place, falls in love with Hayley, thinks the production's wonderful, phones Ted Chapin and says, Ted, you've got to come and see this. It's great. So Ted comes over. He loves it. Then he brings Mary Rodgers. Mary comes over and says, this is the best production of The King and I I've ever seen. And I should know because I saw the original with Gertrude Lawrence and Yul Brynner. So Mary goes back and Ted go back to America. And they tell everybody there's this extraordinary production of The King and I in Australia. It should come to Broadway. So I get a portfolio of photographs and all of this and information on the show to take to New York. So I go to New York and I meet with Ted, and Ted takes me around to different theatre producers around town. And we meet several producers. One producer says to me, hey, you know, we only had The King and I here with Yul about 10 years ago, you know, and, you know, Yul was loved here for this. And he said, look, we could do it. I've got the set. You know, I've got Yule's old set that from the original 1952 production. We could get out, throw a coat of paint on it, and away we go. And I said, oh, no, it's not quite like that. This is on a grand operatic scale. Oh, it won't fit our theatres here on Broadway, you know, because it's quite small, not like yours over there and ours. So we move on. So we're not going to go with that guy because he wants to bring out the old Yul Brynner set. So eventually we come across a group of guys called the Dodgers, who I had worked with many years ago in a show called Big River that I produced, and they produced Big River originally. And so we all meet at Sardi's, of all places. They sit down, they look at the photographs, they look at me, they say, let's do it. So the Dodgers co-produced it on Broadway with the Kennedy Center and us and the Adelaide Festival Center. And so it's happening. They were concerned that Hayley wasn't a big enough name for Broadway, so they didn't want to take Hayley. And then Donna Murphy's name came up, who was sort of a hot potato at the time. And so they wanted to go with her. I didn't really know her work at the time. And they had Lou Diamond Phillips, who I got really excited about because of his movie career and that. So it all sounded really good. So we get to New York, we take the Australian set over, and of course, you know, a lot of the Australian set doesn't fit into the Neil Simon Theatre, so it had to be rejigged and some pieces rebuilt or cut and all of that. So it opens at the Neil Simon Theatre in whatever year it was, 94, 95 or something. And we get, I think we got good reviews. We might have, the New York Times, which was it Frank Rich or one of those other guys, was so about it. But the rest of the reviews were fantastic. And so, of course, the Tony nominations come out and it's nominated for Best Revival of a Musical, which is, you know, the producer, which is us. Brian Thompson, Best Set Design, Roger Kirk, Best Costume Design, and Donna Murphy wins it for Best Actress. So I think it won, what, four or five Tonys. And we had a two-year run there. But leading up to it, it was very, very exciting because I went and spent about 3 months there before the show opened and got to live in New York and that. And I had this fabulous apartment on Madison Avenue. And it was Ted Chapin's father's apartment, and he had moved out because he'd remarried or something. So this was like four bedrooms, and it had a servant's quarters for the maid and all of that. I didn't have a maid. But it was fantastic. I loved it. So we got the show on. The show opened, as I said. But leading up to the Tonys, they turned around and threw, Rodgers and Hammerstein threw a big cocktail party in their offices. And Dame Joan Sutherland was there. I think Barbara Cook came. A lot of people that were involved with Australia came. And a lot of people flew over from Australia for the opening and that. And leading up to the Tonys was really interesting because the it's a bit like Melbourne. When Melbourne leads up to the grand final of the football, like the city goes into this sort of whole madness thing, you know, the papers and its front page of the papers, the television networks pick up all the footage and all of this. And this is just leading up to it. From the nominations through, which is about a 2.5 month, 3 month thing, and it just builds up into this frenzy. And I've never experienced anything like it, certainly in show business. And leading up to it, you know, we had ours at the Majestic Theatre, and I remember being there and sitting in the seats we were allocated, and I was sort of towards the back, and I thought, oh, well, that was certainly, we're not going to get the gong if I'm sitting at the, well, I wasn't sitting at the back, but I was about halfway back, I suppose. Anyway, so the fella gets up on stage before the awards and he says, now, look, if you get up, if you win, make sure you don't fall up the stairs. There's four steps, and no different to going to see a taping of a television show. And that's really what it is. It's a big grand television show. But what was so wonderful about that year, it was the 50th anniversary of the Tonys, and all the Tonys were sort of gold that year. The rest of them have been silver. So I got a gold Tony, which is nice. But that year they brought everybody back that was still alive from the Tonys that were around. So, you know, there was Patricia Neal, there was Liza Minnelli, there was... you name it, they were there. And there is a photograph, which I'll send you.
I'm going to share it on Stage's socials, Instagram and Facebook, so people, listeners, can have a look at that and check it out. It's a wonderful photograph. Right. With you in the middle.
Yeah. Yeah, I got right in the middle. And it was for a curtain call. So it was sort of celebrating 50 years of the Tonys. So I was there, Brian Thompson's there, Roger Kirk's there. And it was with everybody or anybody that was a star in the theater and on television and on film to a degree were there. It was unbelievable. And you know, once you got the award, you were whizzed off to Sardi's across the road, where people that know Sardi's, that whole room was basically, all the tables and chairs were taken out, and it was like a giant cocktail party for all the winners. Or it was like a big green room as such, and you were, you know, given whatever you wanted, you know, a martini or champagne or whatever. But it was sort of like pinch time. I remember standing there pinching myself, thinking, is this real? Is this really happening to me? And it was like wherever you looked, there was a megastar, you know, and it was like, oh, this is weird. Just didn't seem right, but it was right and it was true. So that will certainly was an unforgettable moment for me personally, and certainly for my career, in my career, and that was extraordinary. But what I loved more was the celebration of it. And you know, you would walk down the street a day later and somebody would just come up to you and say, oh, congratulations. Now, I was one of, you know, six or seven producers. How they knew, you know, they must have watched it on television. But, you know, I didn't make a speech. One of the Dodgers did.
It's probably, you were wearing around your neck, weren't you, on a chain? That's how they knew.
Yeah. That's how they knew. That's right. A bit like the Olympics, yeah. So it was just bizarre. It was a bizarre time. And subsequently over the years, you know, I took Jill Perryman to the Tony Awards, a Tony Awards, and introduced her to Carol Channing because Jill was about to play Dolly Levi in Hello Dolly for me. And so, you know, over the years, it's sort of been a fun thing to do. But it was much more fun when it was in a legit house and not at Radio City. But Radio City's good fun too. It's a beautiful space and it's great.
Well, the King and I certainly gave you an entrance card to New York because you also won another Tony Award for Hairspray.
Yeah, for Hairspray. And Hairspray was interesting because I sat through a workshop of Hairspray, and basically all it was really a reading. It was, I remember it was about 18 stools and lecterns and a two or three piece band, and they read the script and sang the songs and played a bit of the music. You know, they'd had, the show wasn't blocked or anything, but they were doing an investor's raising money for it, and we put in $1 million. And I just knew there and then, I thought, this has got hit written all over it. It just ticks every box commercially and entertainment-wise. And, you know, it was fantastic. And then I went to Seattle for the tryouts and then, of course, the opening on Broadway, which was great. It was great night. It was a great night and a great group of people. Your turn, Peter.
This is great. Very, very good. So as a producer of Hairspray on Broadway, you didn't want to produce it in Australia? Because you didn't present it.
No, that's not.
Paul Dainty presented it.
Yeah, well, we had the Australian rights to the producers, and we had an option on the rights to Hairspray as a original producer for Australia. And at the time I was working with a set of other SEL, Sports and Entertainment Limited, another group of producers. And we decided to do the producers first, which we produced with Reg Livermore and Tom Berlinson and Bert Newton and goodness knows who. And at the end of that, Hairspray just kept on being pushed back further. And I think my co-producers in Australia didn't lose. I think they got a little nervous because I think we'd had a couple of flops. We'd had Footloose and we had Man of La Mancha, which was... they were difficult. They weren't successful. So they worried about Hairspray being too Americana, I think. So we got a letter. I remember getting an email saying that, you know, we had a month to renew our rights or they were going to go back to the author's ownership. And for whatever reason, stupidly, the email was never answered. By my co-producers, and we never took the option. And then all of a sudden we hear Paul Dainty was going to produce it as an arena show. And, you know, I knew there and then that you know, Hairspray, the Broadway version of Hairspray is not an arena show. It's a musical in a 1,500, 2,000 seat theatre. That's how it should be presented. So anyway, Paul Dainty decided to do it in a theatre at the Princess, but he wanted to do his own version, and he got David Atkins, and David got a creative team together, and they produced Hairspray, a new version of it. Why they never did the Broadway production, I have no idea. I have no idea. But anyway, Hairspray had a sold a lot of tickets, but I don't know. Probably made money. I don't know. I can't comment on that because I don't know. But yeah, so it was a missed opportunity.
So do you think you'll ever do Hairspray?
Let's say watch this space.
You like teasing. You like teasing, don't you? What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, it's, yeah, I'd love to do it. It's one of my favourite shows, and I won a Tony Award for it. And I'd love Australia to see the production the way it was meant, not with a whole lot of projections.
You're not going to call me and say, can you cut that out?
No, no. I thought you were going to say, you're going to call me and offer me the role.
We'll talk about that offline. Of Edna. Of course, a whole lot of Australians have won Tony Awards now. I'm going to throw a few names at you. So let's see if you can identify what they won for. Tim Chappell and Lizzie Gardner.
Oh, well, that's easy. That was Priscilla.
For what? What was the award, though?
Oh, what was the award? I think, didn't they got it for Priscilla, though, didn't they?
Yeah, but what did they win?
Best costumes.
Yeah, yeah, very good. Hugh Jackman.
Boy from Oz.
Here we go. This will trick. Cyril Richard.
He might have got. Did he get it for that? Oh no, that was a television version. Peter Pan.
No, well, he did get it for Peter Pan.
Oh, there you go, Marty.
She's won four times. Zoe Caldwell, the great Zoe Caldwell.
Oh yeah, she probably got it for Madea.
She did,
and she got it for certainly got it for Masterclass because I saw her do it, and. Oh, I can't remember what the other two would be for.
A film with Maggie Smith.
Oh, Jean Brodie.
Yeah, Primer Jean Miss Brodie. And the fourth one I'd never heard of, Best Featured Actress in 1966 for a play called Slapstick Tragedy.
No, I don't know that one.
Yeah. So you met her, did you say?
She was at the opening night of The King and I, and she was at the party, and I've always wanted to meet her, and I've always been a great fan. I've seen her do a few things. So I went up to her and introduced myself, and she was sitting at the table, and because they were all dinner tables, and I remember going down on my knees saying, introducing myself and that. And I said, I wish you'd come back to Australia and do something. And she said, because when she had come back, she'd come back for the Melbourne Theatre Company. That's the only thing. And she said, oh, no one would remember me. No one would know who I am over there. I said, oh, I think you'd be surprised, because she was a great, great actress. And, you know, she came out. I saw her do Medea with the Melbourne Theatre Company with Patricia Kennedy. And I saw her do The Visit, which she did. She opened the John Sumner Playhouse at the Art Centre in Melbourne. That was the last time she was out here. But sadly, she's passed away now.
She was married to a producer too, Robert Whitehead, wasn't she?
Robert Whitehead, yeah, who was a great, great Broadway producer who produced internationally. I think she's got two kids. Well, they're all grown up now.
Australia is represented this year with the Global Creatures production of Moulin Rouge. And they've got an extraordinary number of nominations. So we wish them all the best. I mean, it's their fourth musical after King Kong, Strictly Ballroom and Muriel's Wedding. So let's hope they can score a bag full of awards for Moulin Rouge, which is in waiting in Melbourne, isn't it, to go on?
Well, it's all ready to go. You know, I believe they tech rehearsed it, they dress rehearsed it, and now it's all just sitting there. While all those poor actors and crew people are counting how many toes they've got. So, they're just waiting. And so who knows? But we'll certainly see it. I went to see it my last Broadway trip. I didn't know what to expect. I was expecting I'd hate it because I didn't care for the film at all. I thought the film was a spaghetti bolognese of nothing. And so I thought, here we go. So I went along and I was just bowled over. I just adored it. I thought it was so good, so beautifully cast, scenically just magnificent, and just Carmen, the producer, has just ticked every box. She's done everything right on that show. And of course, you know, the creative team are all, they're all they're American and English. There's no Australians there, but that's okay. She's got the right people together for it. And I think opening it in New York was a really smart thing to do. And I wish her all the best for it and everybody involved with it. You know, Alex Timbers is a great director, and John Logan, the book writer, pulled it together as a book writer, is doing a great job on it. So, you know, I hope it wins. It deserves to. It's spectacular. But, you know, they're very odd over there, the way they vote, because, you know, the last three years, they've really picked off the wall shows to tick the boxes for. You know, they're not necessarily big blockbuster musicals. They're sort of left of centre, which is fine.
Well, the nominations for Best Musical this year, first time making history, all the nominations are jukebox musicals. Jagged Little Pill, which again was a casualty of COVID in Australia, that was about to open at Theatre Royal or about to go into rehearsal. Moulin Rouge and Tina, yeah. The Tina Turner musical.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, so they're all coming back. I think Jagged Little Pill is about to open back in New York, or it's open. No, it's about to open. And Tina will reopen. Yeah, so it's going to be, I think Moulin Rouge will take it. I think it'll get it. And if it doesn't, well, it's unfortunate because it deserves it. But, you know, they see these shows and they go, oh, that show's making millions of dollars a week and making everybody rich. That's going to be okay. Let's vote for the underdog, you know. So, but, you know, Tina's a great show and will do well. Jagged Pill, I think it'll be between Jagged Pill and that one. So, you know, it's all up for grabs, I suppose, with those two.
Of course, in Australia, our own awards for theatre, creative and performance excellence are the Helpman Awards. Now, they began, they were launched in about 2001, I think.
Yeah.
Were you behind that in the birth of the Helpmans?
No, we were, when I was working with Sports and Entertainment Limited, I'll give James Erskine the credit, but James suggested the design and the sculptor to design that award with the LPA. I don't think it's a very attractive award, actually, but anyway. He designed that. And then I think we were involved with a couple of early award shows, one that we did in the old showroom at Star City, or that was for the JC Williamson Award, I think, whatever. But earlier on, we worked a little bit, and then it was all, then the LPA got heavily involved with it, which was great, which was what it needed to be. But I'd like to see it out of the theatres. I think no one ever buys a ticket. I bet no one in the industry would go out and spend $100 and buy a ticket. They all try and con a ticket for free, and they get a free ticket. So they're not supporting the industry in any way. So I'd rather see it be a dinner, a bit like the Logies, where it is much more, it's simplified, and you're not giving it, you know, to the best bowling alley in Rooty Hill. You know what I'm saying? But there's too many.
Yeah, I was going to say that's a lot of prawn cocktails at that dinner because a lot of people go.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but I don't think you... No, but they won't go because most of them are all... The tickets are given away. What I'm saying is you only invite the nominees.
Right.
So it's a selected invited audience.
Yeah.
And you've got to pay.
Yeah.
John Frost is nominated. I pay. Well, usually if you're nominated, I think you get two free tickets or something. I don't know what you get. They shove it in my hand. I go, no, I'm not going. I won't go to the Helpmans anymore anyway because it's just too boring. So I think it should be a closed shop dinner that the nominees should be invited, and they should be allowed to take two guests or something like that. That should be on. You should buy a table of 10, and keep it at maybe 500 people or 400 people, and you do it in a hotel or a convention center of some sort. That's what I think, because I think doing it in the theaters is too expensive. It's just, well, I know it's far too expensive, and I don't think. And then you can watch it on television if you want to. Watch it on the ABC.
Is the adjudication
anyway,
problematic?
No, not really. I think it's, you know, we all get a vote to who to vote for. You know, we all sit on separate committees.
But I'm just meaning that, you know, with the Tony Awards, it's one theatre district, you know, just in New York. The Green Room Awards in Melbourne are just for what goes on the Melbourne stage. So
yeah,
is it
yeah.
difficult to adjudicate an entire country?
Yeah, I think it is. And if it's a national award show, it's got to be the whole country, you know. And look, I think they've nailed it how to do it. They do it quite successfully, I think. But again, if you were living in Perth and Brisbane, do you hold your breath for the Helpman Awards each year? Probably not, because it's controlled out of Sydney and Melbourne. It's Sydney-Melbourne centric. But the voting system, I think it all needs to be simplified, probably, the whole thing. So, you know, they're not going to do it next year. I reckon it's 2 or 3 years away, even if it comes back again, for that matter.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah.
But, you know, I know they haven't got a lot of money anymore because of COVID. So unless government are going to hand over a lot of money to support an award show, I'd certainly think that the money can be spent a lot smarter than handing out a few gongs to people, don't you think?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
Especially as you say, you know, it's going to be a very tough time crawling back to live performance and making it all return to what it once was, and all of those monetary considerations need to be given that considered thought.
Yeah, that's right, and I think that. It's interesting. Will we get back to what it was like? I'd like to think we will. But, you know, the government's hardly been handing out buckets of money, you know, really for an industry that sells more tickets than the sports industry. But, you know, I can't complain. I've received money from them. So, you know, to get 9 to 5 back on. So, but then, you know, you look at New York, where, you know, I know people there, producers there that have, you know, received checks for up to $30, $40 million for their shows from the government. But we're not America. We don't have 250, 300 million people, and we're not as wealthy as that country. So, and you don't come to Australia to see a Broadway show, do you? You come and see a kangaroo and the beaches or whatever, you know. So it's all different.
So 9 to 5, you've hinted at. What's next for Crossroads Live in 2022?
Right. Well,
that you can talk
postponed,
about.
Yeah, I can. I'm the boss, so I can tell you whatever I like. And then they'll just tell me to shut up, and I'll ring you and say, can you cut that from the thing? And you'll say, too late. No. Well, no, 9 to 5 is going back. We, We're opening that in when are we opening that? February, at the Lyric, I think. No, we're not at the Lyric. Are we at the Lyric or the Capitol? One of them in Sydney. And then the plan is to put reopen. We haven't closed it yet, but we haven't opened it. Cinderella will go out again. We'll try and go out about mid-year for a national tour.
So Cinderella is another addition to your Rodgers and Hammerstein canon. You've done South Pacific and Sound of Music, yeah, and The King and I. You obviously love R&H.
I love them because I think they know how to write a tune, as our American friends talk about. I'm a traditionalist, and look, you know, I'd rather sit through Rodgers and Hammerstein and Lerner and Lowe than lots of other things. And I love the sweeping stories. They were masterpieces of their time and still are, I think. And, you know, there's been a lot of criticism about, oh, you can't produce a Rodgers and Hammerstein musical anymore because it upsets too many people, or, you know, it offends this and it offends that and whatever. Well, if we all thought that way, you know, we'd be producing nothing. And I will continue to produce these pieces because they certainly don't offend me, and seeing I'm paying the money to get them on, they'll be happening. So, and they shouldn't be lost. You don't say that about Shakespeare or any other playwrights. So why would you do it about Rodgers and Hammerstein? Or, you know, My Fair Lady, for that matter. It's another one I want to revive eventually. We can't lose our history too much.
Absolutely not. No. Frosty, thank you for coming back and doing another episode of Stages. Our pilot episode was such a success that we were given the go ahead for this series. I've had lots of terrific feedback on your episodes.
Oh, good. That's good. No, I played them back and listened to them, and I thought they were quite good too. I thought, oh, you're quite interesting, actually. And somebody said to me, you know, you should write a book and that. And I just thought, oh, I think we need to wait for a few people to die and then I can really be honest, you know. So,
well, you haven't disappointed today. You haven't disappointed today. You've thrown a few hand grenades. I'm just waiting for them to go off.
Yeah, well, that's always the fun bit. Let's do that. The fun bit is waiting for them to go off, and then because I you know, I'm not a party to Facebook and all that other stuff. I just don't play that game. So I don't know what they write. So it's good. So I can say whatever I like to say and I don't answer back because I don't know what they're saying. But then on the other hand, they may not be saying anything. And so that would be even more upsetting to me. So as long as they're talking about you, you're okay.
There is certainly no one like Frosty. He's the ideal guest, equipped with tremendous passion and knowledge of the business, a vast supply of anecdote, and a candid confidence to call it as he sees it. I direct you to the two-part conversation that Stages recorded with John in Series 2. It's an engaging tale of the 15-year-old Adelaide boy who ran away to join the circus and wound up as ringmaster, the consummate showman, John Frost. As stated in the conversation, I will share on Stage's socials the 50th anniversary Tony Awards photograph, where hopefully you can spot John, Roger Kirk and Brian Thompson. Check out the Stage's Facebook page and Stage's podcast on Instagram. I must point out also and clarify that early in the episode I referred to this year's Tony's being the 79th. It's actually the 74th. Sorry about that slip. Thought it best to rectify, clarify, clear that up, as I'm sure there is a fellow show queen out there screaming 74, 74 at their listening device. Also, good news, if you're wanting to catch the 74th Tony Awards, they will be screened live by 10 Peach on Monday morning. Thank you, Channel 10, for bringing the theatre grand final to all of us musical theatre fans. Well, theatre fans, because of course the awards encompass plays as well and all the creative arts. Following the broadcast, you can then catch up through the streaming service Paramount Plus. Thanks for joining us in this episode, and thanks to my guest today, Frosty the Showman,
John Frost. I'm Peter Eyers. Keep well, keep warm, stay safe, and I'll catch you next time.